At the end of the stairs, she reaches for her coat. Her hand dangles stupidly in the air. She's done it before. Opened the hall door to the dark, stepped outside, and circled the same dead streets for an hour or an hour and a half. Last time, he told her he'd imagined the worst. He'd called, but she left her phone behind, and it had vibrated on the shelf at her side of the bed, waking the baby. He makes a practice of worrying, but that's not why she's afraid to go out. She pictures him writing in a secret notebook, incident reports with dates. The time she'd accidentally stayed in the bath long after the water had cooled. The time he'd come home from work to find the baby wet and soiled. She pictures him using the notebook in court, reading from it in a shaking voice, or showing it to a doctor who takes it as proof and signs her into a hospital cell. He would seem like a grieving husband, a husband who had always done his best. "As soon as you're better," he'd say when she asked to be allowed home. "We're all trying to help. I wish you trusted me." The screaming stops while the baby gathers breath. Above her, the floorboards squeak. In their bedroom, or what used to be their bedroom, he'll be walking over to the Moses basket and leaning down, reaching in for the baby. She should feel guilty. Guilt should be tormenting her. But she feels nothing other than hazy relief and the beginning of hunger pangs. Her life is full of strange correlations. The more he kisses and comforts the baby, the more she eats. Bricks of butterscotch chocolate. Cold potatoes straight from the fridge. "You'll get there," he said when he caught her looking at her stomach in the mirror. "Give yourself a few months. It's early days." She couldn't tell him that she's not bothered by her weight. The baby stretched her, and she doesn't want to lose the evidence of what happened to her body like she lost the idea of the baby. When the midwife laid the real baby on her chest, the baby in her head died, and with it her sense of humour. She couldn't tell him that she feels thinner than she is, a thin woman in a tiny house playing a series of outsized roles. "Play with him," her husband said yesterday, blowing on the baby's tummy. "He loves to be played with." Too young to smile, the baby stared at her with his black eyes. "See how he responds," her husband said, and pretended to eat the baby's feet. She closes the kitchen door behind her, trying to shut out the force of the screams. From this distance, with bricks and steel and wood in the way, she can listen to the sound patterns without feeling sick and almost appreciate their charge. In the bedroom, her husband shushes the baby, using the tone he used to use with her before they'd have sex. She sits at the kitchen table and layers crisps in a soft white roll, crunching through the high flavour, chewing the bread back to dough. Food silences the memories. Women used to be prayed over by a priest to purify them of childbirth. She wishes she could be purified, released, freed from the delivery room. The frantic bleeping of the monitor, the spiked traps of pain, the forceps that dragged the baby from her, ripping through to her sphincter. When she looks at the baby's face, his hair so much darker than hers, she thinks that it can't be true. He can't be her son. The word son weighs too much, almost as much as the word mother. Yet they share the same hunger, his fist always rammed to his mouth. And while the stump of his cord was withering, they both smelled of rotting fish, her body reminding her that he was knitted from her bones and blood. She fingers the inside of the crisp packet, licking grease and crumbs from her hands, and turns on the small TV. Her husband did not want a TV in the kitchen or anywhere else in the house. He will have the baby playing with hand-carved wooden toys and hyping up Lugnaquilla at weekends. He does not hold with easy options such as television and processed food. He has taken her failure to breastfeed as his own, assuming responsibility for the steriliser and preparing the bottles before work. Though the day they came home from the hospital, he referred to the infant formula as cat food. "I'm joking," he said too quickly, leading her to think that he had planned the comment. "It's just a joke." She idles through the channels, pausing on a documentary set in Dublin Zoo. An animal is sick. An animal that looks like a cross between an anteater and a pig. The kitchen door opens. "He's asleep," her husband says. "Well done," she says, then wonders if he might resent the praise, because he is doing her job, playing the baby's mother. When they'd gone on their first walk as a threesome, he had pushed the pram. "I'll feed him," he'd said on the way home, "and you can light the fire." In their previous life, they'd have laughed at that division of labour. But there was nothing funny about either of their tasks. He fed the baby powder and water. She lit a log made from paraffin and sawdust, agreeing with him when he reminded her again of just how blessed they were. It would be so much better, she'd thought, if his breasts were swollen with milk, if there was a forest at the back of the house that she could trawl for kindling, snaring rabbits and pheasants as she went. He comes to stand beside her, leaving the door ajar. She waits for a comment like the one about the cat food. "A taper," he says. "What? That's a taper. Is it? I saw one in Brazil on a midnight hike." Before her, he had been a hardcore traveller. For their honeymoon, they'd compromised and gone to New Zealand. He'd persuaded her to climb the Franz Josef Glacier the morning after an electric storm. The guide cut steps into the ice, but even with crampons and a trekking pole, she'd struggled to stay upright. On the way through a crevice, she'd fallen into a waist-deep stream of freezing water. Afterwards, he came to accept that she preferred luxury hotels by the beach. "Gorgeous animals," he sits on the chair next to her. "Aren't they?" There is an invitation in the question, and with it comes pressure to answer well. She looks for beauty in the creature's stunted trunk and its ears sitting high above its eyes. It lumbers after its keeper, who, a voiceover says, has been taking care of it for 3 years. "Unusual, anyway," she says. 2 months before, the voiceover says, the taper had a miscarriage, and since then she's been out of sorts. The vet changed her antibiotics twice, but her form has not improved. "She'll have to be euthanized," the vet says. The taper's keeper turns away from the camera. The documentary cuts to a commercial break. Her husband swings around to face her. "They won't do it. They're just creating drama." She nods, wishing she had paused on a trashy film or one of the American news channels he despises. They sit out the first ad. He does not ask her to mute the sound. There is some solidarity in the act of watching, and she considers reaching over and taking his hand. "Whereabouts in Brazil?" she asks instead. He frowns. Place names mean nothing to her unless she is planning or recalling a trip of her own. "The rainforest." "What was it like?" He stares at the shells in the corner. She remembers the Saturday he assembled them. He worked bare-chested, listening to the Smiths on a loop, refusing lunch until the shells were ready. That evening, she painted them purple. They'd looked at the colour chart separately and picked out the same lilac shade. "What?" he says. "The tapir or the rainforest?" "Either," she says. "Both." "Good," he says, like a child who has been asked about his day in school. The documentary resumes. The vet gives the tapir an anaesthetic. Her husband stares at the screen without blinking. "Turn it off." "I'm sorry," she says, killing the TV. Nothing can just happen anymore, he says. Nothing is allowed to just happen. She takes his hand. They shouldn't have let the cameras in. It's not the zoo's fault. I didn't think you believed in zoos. Believe, he says. You don't believe or not believe in zoos. He looks at her hand on top of his. She has never seen him cry. Before the baby, she'd have liked him to break down, but if he cried now, she'd be cold to his tears. If you don't want to talk to someone, he says, there are pills that might help. She lets her hand fall away. Once they were friends, but the friendship has turned, and there is something sordid in how they have become like other married couples. She is too tired to fight with him. She needs all of her energy to fight with herself. Okay. You'll need to go to the GP. The fridge hums into the silence. She pictures its two bottom drawers full of softening vegetables and the selection of cheeses her sister brought. When he goes back to bed, she will take out the brie, cut away the skin, and lick the buttery cheese off the knife. I can ring, he says. There's no need, I can ring myself. He sighs, preparing to say something else, something kinder, perhaps. But the baby whimpers above them and he gets up. He's not due a feed for another hour, but I might feed him anyway. I can do it. There's no need. Why don't you go back to bed? She listens to the slap of his feet on the stairs and wonders what is to stop her from crossing the kitchen and filling the kettle with water to heat the baby's bottle. What is to stop her from insisting that she feed the baby? His head fits into the crook of her arm. He drinks easily, and when he has finished, sucks air through the plastic teat. She leaves the kitchen, passing her husband, who is carrying the baby, against his chest and shoulder. In the bedroom, she lies on cold sheets, facing the Moses basket her mother gave them on loan. When she was 8, warm in bed, with rain battering the roof and the sound from across the hall of her sister running a bath, she had known that everyone she loved was safe. Her parents downstairs, her brother asleep on the paisley beanbag. Unless one of them sickened suddenly or a fire broke out from her mother's forgotten cigarette, her family would survive for another night at least. But she and her husband are not family. And no matter what they do, they can't make the world safe for the baby. And they are too spoilt to accept this. Spoilt in different ways. So they will spoil the baby in different ways to try and make amends. She pulls the duvet over her. The darkness is another skin. 3 years ago exactly, she and her husband were in New Zealand and there was no one in the house. She imagines pausing her life as it is and travelling back in time, soaking up the empty silence, haunting her childless past. Through the ceiling, she hears the baby sneeze and the hum of the fast-boiling kettle.